Welcome to this edition of This Is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world. And now, your co-hosts, Dave Gilmore and Lynn Barrett.
Welcome. This is Lynn. Recently, my co-host, Dave Gilmore, was on the road again and had a chance to sit down with Holly St. Clair, Chief Technology Officer at Sasaki. Prior to joining Sasaki, where she oversees the strategy and implementation of their digital environment, Holly served as Massachusetts' first Chief Digital and Data Officer. She is recognized as an innovator and a change agent, with a history of using data and technology in ways that help people and their governments interact to achieve better outcomes. On this edition of This is Design Intelligence, we'll hear their conversation.
So, thanks again for taking the time to come and spend time with us. You have a very interesting career path because you were in the world of urban planning and changing massive landscapes, of thinking about how humans and infrastructure and buildings would all be conceived ahead of anything starting and then it doing. And somehow along the way, perhaps as a natural or learned proclivity, you moved into the world of technology and its ultimate yield, which is data. Mm-hmm. What was that? How did that happen?
Well, early when I went to Tufts University, the Urban Environmental Policy and Planning program there, we had a practical project where you collaborate with a nonprofit. And I was working with a group of Chelsea moms. Chelsea's a town near Boston. And they wanted to understand who were the industrial and factory owners on both sides of this creek that was being polluted. And it was really hard to get that data. I camped out in different lobbies and ambushed different government administrators to try to get the data. And it occurred to me that data was really important for communities to be able to engage in these planning, design, and policy and government conversations that were happening all the time.
Because they're uninformed without it, right?
Well, they're informed in a different level, right?
Okay.
They're informed on what's really happening on the ground, what the impacts are on their families. They just might not know the fabric that's invisible behind the scenes that might help govern a lot of that.
Okay.
And so, you know, this was before open data. And so that really just gave me an idea that I really needed to help make that data more accessible. So that started my sort of first mission, which was to open data. So I went and got a job at the department that would not originally give me the data, and that was the Department of Neighborhood Development.
Amazing.
For the city of Boston. So I went to the research department there and studied housing foreclosures, because there was a big housing foreclosure crisis at that time. So that started the work, and then I pretty quickly outgrew the idea that we could solve the problems that we were facing around housing, affordability, transportation, the economy, that we could solve it within the city boundaries of Boston. We're never going to solve our problems if we're not looking beyond our town boundaries. So then I went and got a job at the Metropolitan Area Planning Council and started to work on the Boston Indicators Project with two amazing women who are visionaries, Charlotte Kahn, who was then at the Boston Foundation, and Gita Pradhan, who was also at the Department of Neighborhood Development and then the Boston Foundation. And the Boston Indicators Project was a real sort of game changer for community and neighborhood data.
And
that's how I started.
And so that's how you got involved. So you jumped out because you saw a burden that was needing to be understood, lifted, and expressed in a new way. And each time you hit a wall, you'd say, well, this is constraining. I'm going to jump out to the next level. Well, how in the world did you end up as the chief data security person of the Commonwealth?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
well,
the next big...
You know, a lot of these terms are still being defined. I was lucky enough to have... There was a security officer. There's another chief security officer. I was more in chief data officer and chief digital officer.
Okay.
And so the way that came about is, you know, I continued throughout my career to specialize in using data, information, and technology to engage citizens and government or institutions to work together to bring their knowledge to the table, their data to the table, to make better informed decisions together. And so when Bill Oates, who's the former CEO of, CIO of Boston, who then at that time was the CIO of the state, he had tapped me to come open the first data office for the state. And at that time, it's sort of when open data was really becoming really hot, and the idea of trying to figure out how we could better utilize our data in the state was something Bill was really interested in. And at that time, yes, of course, Governor Baker.
So give me a practical example for our listeners of, we talk about getting access to data to do certain things with, to help inform better decisions, et cetera. Give me a practical example of what that meant?
Sure. I'll use the state context. I think one of the things people assume is that the state and government can share data very easily across different organizations and departments. Well, that's not necessarily the truth, especially in Massachusetts, where our privacy laws are very strict. And as you know, and around the country, we're suffering from opioids, the opioid epidemic. And that was a major, and still is a major priority of Governor Baker to solve that epidemic. And so the legislature passed something called Chapter 55, which was a research project to look at opioid deaths and what was happening preceding that. So for the first time, we had legislation that gave us time-boxed wedge in privacy policy, so we could look at behavior from 10 different data sets around individuals and what happened leading up to their deaths.
Wow.
So looking at, you know, prison records, looking at prescription records, a variety of different other records from different departments, and figuring out how to share that data, maintain privacy, and then come out with meaningful recommendations within 1 year. And this work was really
That's
being led.
Accelerated.
Yeah. This work was really led in terms of the strategy and content was really led by the Department of Public Health and Commissioner Burrell. But I was more behind the scenes with the IT and trying to figure out the strategy and the privacy and the different algorithms and how we'd engage with the data.
That's a great example.
Yeah. And then ultimately that led to a groundbreaking study, which then we created what I call New York Times style data story on. On the web, which was, let's not just do a PDF or, 50-page report that's full of text and graphs that no one's going to read. Let's put it on the web. Let's make it interactive. Let's use video. Let's use interactive visualizations that allow people to look at state numbers and figure out what it means on a town level so that they could take town-level action.
That's pragmatism.
Yeah.
At its best, right?
Yes. I prefer to be practical.
So... Holly, and just sitting here with you, you have an energy, a drive that's there. Has that always been that way? Or what's driving Holly St. Clair to be so intentional about the things that you give yourself to?
That's interesting. I feel like there's so much that we can do with what we have. And being visionary sometimes just means being practical and saying, let's just look at what we have and look at how to use the best that we have to make the best impact that we have.
Yeah, so leveraging our current resources, because we just don't.
We don't.
At the end of the day.
No. We often are missing diversity of actors at the table who have new information. We're often not disciplining ourselves to have the proper policies and processes
right.
in place.
Yeah. So this is a leap. So out of that whole space of government and public world and being, as you said, constrained by privacy laws, et cetera, now we're suddenly moving into a private space, a firm close to 400 people that do global urban planning, massive landscape work, some architecture work, master planning things. They're just an amazing group of people who have gone through their own reinvention over the last few years in an extraordinary way. But now here you come with this passion and this this broader context. How do we see that translating down into the practice of design within Sasaki?
That's a great question. So when I was at the state, I wasn't just the chief data officer, I was also the chief digital officer. And I was charged with helping to start digital transformation at the state.
Got it.
And that really means, sort of taking a lens from looking at your market from the inside out and really thinking of things siloed in different organizational or administration services and how you can bring them to customers and really shifting to more of a looking from the outside in, thinking of our customers' perspective and how do they look at us and how do we serve them.
Uh-huh.
So for state government, you no longer need to know which window, which building to go to get to that permit. You just want the permit. You just know the government needs to give it to you, and you just want it as fast as possible.
Right.
You usually want it while you're waiting in line at the supermarket. You know, you're doing a couple things at once. That's a very different environment to provide providing services in.
Mm-hmm.
So that digital transformation linked with my background in data and technology and planning for over 15 years. You know, I was at the state for 4 years. I replatformed the website. I was ready for my next challenge. And it just happened that James and I often, James Miner, who's the CEO of Sasaki, mm-hmm. Were often in touch because when I was at the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, I was creating something called decision support tools. These were applications that would help in planning processes, would help bring those decision makers and data and community members to the table to make better decisions together. And Sasaki, you know, is always a groundbreaker and, or groundbreaking in innovation. And they were creating, I think, the beginnings of something called My Campus and how you take surveys and gather information from people about a place and how they could do that on the web and how mm-hmm. they could do that easily. So I was always watching their work mm-hmm. and interested in collaborating with them. And so James sent me an email and said, hey, do you know any good CTOs? I said, well, I'm sort of wrapping up here. I'd be interested in trying to, you know, put my hat in the ring for that. And he was excited. And, you know, Sasaki is an amazing company. They they don't just design. They have a point of view.
The true point of view.
And they're developing a really strong mission, which for me, mission statements have also been a big driver for me. So
you made a wonderful distinction, which is common for you, but uncommon for so many people, data, digital. I was the chief data officer. I was the chief digital officer. And, you know, in this space, that is the built environment among architects particularly, the transformation to digitalization has been like slow molasses in the winter. You know, I mean, it's been very, very, as well as it's misunderstood. What is it? What is the scope of it? What's the point of it? What and so there's a radical need for education prior to implementation in this space. It'll be interesting as you start to interface with many of the other technical leaders, with their technology leaders within peer firms, to really understand, are you there? Do you understand where we are? I think you have a significant advantage because you've already gone through trying to understand, define, redefine, and move forward with some things. One thing I'm curious, though, is have you had, and I know you've hit the ground running, you're rocking and rolling, have you had any opportunity to think through what must I, Holly, unlearn in order to learn this new domain?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm still in the learning process. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the benefits of being at Sasaki's is not just planning. It's also architecture and interior design and engineering in some cases, and landscape engineering.
Yeah.
And so I'm used to operating at 30-year time horizons and never seeing built yet what I planned for, although that's changing quite a bit now that I'm going on 20 years here in the field. But, you know, at Sasaki, you can design things and then a year or two later, see it built.
You see it. Yeah.
Right? So that's pretty exciting. And so that shifting of the time scale is very interesting, as well as I think the shifting of the virtual and the real realms coming together with the Internet of Things and augmented reality, virtual reality, and thinking about how that process could be really different with the new technologies and how it's not just something that we use at the beginning or the middle or the end. It's the whole cycle improvement, continuing to improve and get feedback and improve. And really just thinking about the different ways we should be getting feedback, whether it's facilities, like literally the pipes in the building, or whether it's the way something feels to the people who are in the space.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of what do I have to unlearn, I have not asked myself that question yet.
Oh, great.
Because I'm always just trying to learn and be open to new ways of doing things.
Right.
I will have to think about that.
You think about that one, and sometime I'll have you back, and we'll see. We'll pick that one up.
How about in a year I can come back and I'll tell you what I've unlearned.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's interesting. About a year ago, I traveled to a lot of firms. Last year in 2019, I visited with 56 firms with their boards and leadership and personally. So I'm a road warrior. And one of the things that I would say, because this construct of architects and engineers, maybe constructors as well, they're so obsessed right now with data. It's like they found something new. It's very exciting, right? While pharmaceuticals have been dealing with big data forever, mm-hmm. and the government agencies, et cetera. So it's become this obsession to the point that it's all about data. And so my opening statement has been, data is nothing.
That's correct.
Knowledge is something. Understanding is everything, yeah. Right? How do you respond to that kind of statement, knowing that you're completely immersed in your thinking around this space?
Yeah, I think the only addition I would add to your brilliant statements there were, you know, the data needs to be transformed into information. When we put it within a framework, a governance framework, or a framework of business objectives. I guess the easiest way I can explain it is during a regional planning process, mm-hmm. we are choosing indicators for how could we judge or what would we look at to decide if we were having success or not. And someone put forward, well, the age of homes, that's a good data point we should be putting in there. And he said, well, is an old house a good thing or a bad thing? And they're like, I don't know.
I guess I was assuming it was bad.
No, but some of the best bones were in the 20s and 30s.
Houses, right?
You know, yeah. My house is from the turn of the century in Boston. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Do I want a house that was built in the 60s, 70s? Sometimes no. So the age of a house means nothing unless you're clear about what your business goals are and objectives, or in that case, is regional values and planning.
Yeah, so this really begs something. And we were having a discussion with someone recently, and he was lamenting that so many firms, architectural firms, their data sets are so confused that they can't really speak about success from project to project to project to project because they're not comparable. And the statement came out, as we do in business, we always set performance indicators on the front end of a pro forma, and then we measure against those across the life cycle of the investment or whatever our project is. While often in American architecture, that's just not done. Mm. We're just happy we got a building out the door.
That's right.
And then we just go, hooray, and we go off and run and do the next one.
Yeah.
By nature, going to bring that kind of consciousness to Sasaki, whether it has it already or not, mm-hmm. is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, so there's a couple pieces of that. One is I just got through interviewing all the principals at Sasaki, and there's some brilliant thought leaders. It's been some great conversations.
Yes.
And I asked, one of the things I asked them, is there any data set that you don't have that you need to make better decisions about our work and how we deliver to our clients? And almost all of them said something that was related to our internal data. I was not ready for that, although I should have been after all my experience so far. But I was ready to, you know, figure out something we had to put sensors out for or to buy. And no, it was our internal data, whether it's rules of thumb or metrics from our existing projects, our portfolio. And so first we have to get our own house in order and figure out what the single source of truths are, what the governance is about our data, relating it to our business objectives and strategies, and then figuring out how to look at that across projects. I think that's a really good point that I want to take a little bit of a side journey on, which mm-hmm. is part of digital transformation is shifting from projects that are standalone to products. And I do think this is something that we need to start thinking about mm-hmm. in the architecture industry, in design and planning. You know, everything we do, we think of as a very creative endeavor. And everything is very bespoke. All great things, but we also need to figure out how to do things faster, more efficient. We need to save the creative energy for that spark, that amazing creative moment. It doesn't need to be about our file structure or how do I translate this from Revit to Grasshopper to whatever. You know, we need to figure out what we can streamline and industrialize and figure out the processes so they're repeatable and measurable. So you can save our creativity for where it really
that's
needs
it,
to be.
Because the magic of design isn't in that stuff.
Right. But yeah. By its nature, the folks who are doing that creativity, the amazing minds, really like to do things their own way.
Yeah.
And so when you have a group of amazing minds, it's sort of an interesting experience that I'm just entering to try to figure out how can we collectively decide where we want to go and help our technology and processes meet us there.
And their design paradigms are deeply entrenched. So to be able to come up and let go of things that really are not truly value added to the total creative process, allow let go of it, and I can show you that you'll have a faster, better, more valuable product as the result. I love that distinction between project to products. That's a
yeah, and it's a subtle one. It took me a while to figure it out, and I'm not sure I have it figured out yet. But I do think it's important to think about that differently. I think the other piece that's hard for people to understand who haven't worked with data or algorithms or even technology to understand that there's a lot of creativity there too. Even though it might feel like it's very rote, it's very zeros and ones, there's a lot of creativity there too. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a different form. And once you can see through that sort of veil, you start to understand the creativity and what the new form of it is.
Yeah. One of the things, I'm going to take a left turn here, one of the things that has been so wonderfully inspiring to me in going to Sasaki is looking at their very clear social agenda.
Yeah.
And
it's one of the major reasons I joined the firm.
Yeah. It's amazing how if our listeners could see me, I have my hands out like this. They're postured like this, right? Which is inclusive and accepting, and show me what you got.
Yeah. But I do think the design better together tagline is like critical.
Yeah.
Not just for including those at the table who are necessarily usually at the table. But also for thinking about sustainability as we move forward. Mm-hmm. Because really, you know, we see so many amazing like landscapes that Olmsted set up and different, you know, I'm so excited to see the Salk Institute tomorrow. You know, some of those designers had such forethought about what the future would be like and who and how we needed the spaces to feel and who we were serving with those spaces. I feel like sometimes we lose that in the current day and age when we're just trying to deliver a project. And so I do think having those open arms and thinking about how to do that while thinking about how to move things from a bespoke project to a product is a really interesting conundrum that I think the whole field's in right now.
But back to the earlier statement, because the firm has postured itself with this openness, it's more ready to learn in those constructs, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is really a powerful thing. How do you see research playing into Sasaki going forward with now being empowered with this new mindset that you're bringing into the firm?
Well, I think, you know, one of the most amazing things that Sasaki's done is they do have this internal research program where they've funded internal research. So different teams will put together different proposals and they're internally judged and then given some time set aside to then bring it to fruition. Sometimes it can relate to a product or a project in the future. Sometimes it's just so we learn. And so just acknowledge that learning is a value is so important.
Yeah.
And the reality of our workforce, of those amazing talented people that are coming out of the schools that we have in Boston and beyond, you know, they're looking for this social agenda and the meaning in their work. They're looking to learn every day and keep learning as they came out of, you know, MIT or Harvard. And they're looking for a diverse set of questions and, you know, collaborators across the table.
Right.
So part of what Sasaki is doing is we're not just building the buildings of tomorrow. We're creating our leaders and our thinkers for tomorrow.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that's going on there.
Yeah.
And if they don't continue to be inspired, they'll leave.
Yeah.
So it's critical to the retention of great talent that you're postured in this way as well.
I also think there's a piece around technology too. It's really hard. You need some amount of investment to sort of spec on some technology applications, and you know, client budgets can't always support that. So sometimes you need to make some internal investments to figure out how to do that new dashboard, how to do that new virtual reality, augmented reality application that you want to build. You know, how to make this meaningful? How do we sense our data so that it's looking at the right questions? So there is some internal investment, and I love the idea of it, but thinking about not just investing in our people, but also investing in our technology infrastructure, and especially when that goes hand in hand together. That's powerful.
Right. And of course, It's always a challenge in traditional architecture that if it's not a billable hour, what do I do, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's moving from an expense mindset to an investment mindset.
That's right. And that was our shareholders and our board taking that leadership. And James Miner was, I'm sure, you know, a critical mind behind
right
that.
And
so I think that decision is going to be one that's going to set Sasaki apart from the competition.
I'm very excited about this and the future of the firm. Yeah. So last thing, if you had anything in the world you wanted to say to a very large audience, what would you want to say? Go Red Sox? No, I'm kidding.
I think just keep asking questions and being aware of our own bias and understanding how that perspective might change if we are in a different position, because, you know, architects understand the different perspective angle, like literally with buildings. Yes. And I think sometimes we need to apply that sort of flexibility and thinking to the way that we approach problems that we're facing today.
That's just fantastic. That's great. Holly, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This Is Design Intelligence. Sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This Is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.